Maine, Maine, Maine Outdoors. From Rangeley to Eastport, Fort Kent to Kittery, the Maine Outdoors is waiting for all of us to see. The mountains, lakes, and rivers, the wildlife and the woods are just outside your doorway, so get outside and find it in the Maine Outdoors. Fishing and hunting, winter, spring, summer, and fall. If it happens in the Maine Outdoors, they talk about it all. Just tune in your radio to 103.9. Jim and Paul and Bob and Matt are your Outdoors Hotline. Each Sunday night at 7 on WVOM. To find out what is happening, just listen to the radio to the Maine Outdoors.
Welcome to the Maine Outdoors. Here's tonight's host, V. Paul Reynolds.
Thank you, sir, and good evening, one and all. Hey, Robert, how about those Boston Red Sox?
I almost wore my Boston hat tonight, but I didn't want to go, ape.
Yeah. Did the third baseman there, Rafael Devers, is that his name?
Yes, he's quite a player.
What a throw to first base.
Oh, man, and what's that guy's name? Pius.
Yeah.
He's been knocking runs in all over the place, along with Bradley Jr. Yeah. And
that was a great game last night.
We
digress. This is not a sports show. This is a hunting, fishing, hiking, camping show. But we just had to recognize the Boston Red Sox.
I should say.
Hey, we're glad to have you with us tonight on Maine Outdoors, Maine's longest-running outdoor talk radio program. If you'd like to be on our show tonight, we have a toll-free statewide number you can call.
1-800-966-1039. And you must dial the whole number, even if you're local.
Yes, sir.
1-800-966-1039.
And we have an interesting program tonight. I'll introduce our two guests in just a moment. First, the crew who make this show possible every week. My esteemed co-host, a registered Maine guide, a former game warden, and an author of three great fishing books, my friend Bob Lehman.
Thank you, Paul. We got a great show tonight. You really stay up close to the radio tonight.
You bet.
This is going to be a good one.
I think so. And our crew, the engineers, two engineers tonight. Scotty Bates is away at chasing ghosts down in Connecticut or something. But anyway, our chief engineer, the man from Eddington, the banjo-picking bush flyer from Eddington. Is it Eddington or Orrington?
Orrington.
Mr. Jim Layton. Take a bow, Jim.
Good evening, folks. Pull up a chair. Buckle up your seat belts. It's going to be a great show tonight.
And with Jim, to his right, our assistant engineer in training. Are you still in training, Norm?
I don't know yet.
Yeah. Well, I think you got rid of that training bicycle. Yeah,
he's not in training.
Yeah. We call him Mr. Chili, the sweetheart of Grand Lake Stream, Norman F. Plord.
Good evening, everybody. And yes, Scotty's down in, actually, it's Rhode Island, I believe.
Oh, is that where he is?
Yeah.
Chasing goblins or something.
Newport, Rhode Island.
Oh, all right. Anyway, we welcome Scotty back when he gets here. I'd like to introduce our guests at this time, a couple of gents who have agreed to. One of them drove all the way down from Fort Kent, and that is, we don't get that very often. We certainly appreciate that. Jake Morrill has been on our program in the past. He's a former bush pilot, and he ran a sporting camp called Hardscrabble Lodge. He wrote a book about it. We've had him on the show talking about his book, and then he wrote another book, which is an interview with Gary Dumont, a retired Maine warden pilot from Fort Kent. And Gary, we'd like to welcome you and Jake to Maine Outdoors.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. And they've got a great new book called Gary Dumont Remembers, Maine Warden Pilots. And if you have any questions for either of these gents, we'll welcome your calls at 1-800-966-1039. Before we get to our guests, however, we have Outdoor Digest. Just a couple things to remind you, the Digest is brought to you each week by the Northwood Sporting Journal. And my partner, Vic Morin, is looking for some part-time sales folks. If you're interested in getting into advertising sales, we will train you and we provide generous commissions. You can give Vic a call at 732-4880 during normal working hours. That's 732-4880. Before we get to Bobby's famous fishing report, just a deer season opener reminder that the firearm season on white-tailed deer is now officially open as of Saturday for Maine residents, and starting tomorrow morning for anybody who has a Maine hunting license. And it's going to be a good season from all reports. The deer biologist, Nathan Bieber, says that they expect to have a good harvest this year. They've issued more doe permits than any time in history of the state 84,700.
Holy mackerel, that is. Somewhere around 65,000 won it last year.
Yeah, it's up 28%.
Well, I should say.
And I got one over in Wayne. My wife got one. You got one.
I got one for Lincolnville.
Did you? All right. We'll have to go down there.
You're going to get some meat then, aren't you?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. So anyway, the deer season's on. We just want to remind everybody there are 215,000 licensed Maine hunters. We'll be out in the woods for the next month, and we remind everybody, remember, get permission. If you're going to be hunting on private land, make sure you get the okay, and it doesn't hurt to knock on doors and ask for that permission. It's always a nice thing to do. And again, if you have a tree stand, remember, you have to label that with your name, address, and telephone number. That is the law. And of course, we always remind you to remember, gun safety is always a priority in the Maine woods. Be careful where you point that gun and make sure you know your target, and everybody will come out of the season, we hope, with a very safe Maine deer hunting season.
You didn't have any luck during the bow season.
No, I didn't. No, I spent a lot of time sitting in the ground blind eating peanuts.
Did
but,
you? Didn't see a deer at all?
No, I had them on the game camera, but
did you?
No shots were taken, but we had a great time.
That's all right. Well, you can get one in the regular hunting season.
Well, I'm going to try.
Attaboy.
Yeah. Okay, I think now it's time for Bob's favorite music. And you'll have to help him through this, Jim.
Yeah.
I'm a big boss bass.
Yeah.
And you work for me.
Yeah.
All
this right. Is my rock.
Yeah.
Okay. We do crazy things here, Gary. Okay, Bob, what's going on in the fishing world?
Well, that was apropos, you might say, that tune tonight, because I'm going to talk about bass.
All righty. Second favorite fish.
Yeah, a good friend of mine and yours, young Evan Thomas of Winterport, whose father is a doctor. You know him, don't you? Scotty Thomas?
Yeah, he
works
goes
over
to our church.
St. Joe's, yep.
Yeah.
In the ER. Well, young Evan Thomas went fishing into Push-Off Lake yesterday.
Yeah.
He said it was cold and miserable and everything. Yeah. He caught 35 bass.
Did he really?
He did, and he caught him on what they call a jerk bait. You know what a jerk bait is?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You throw it out there, let it set there a few minutes, and he said he did exactly what you're supposed to do with a jerk bait. So let it set there a few minutes, and then give it a jerk or two. And he said every time he did that, whammo.
Good.
This time of year, that's unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine it. You know, you think salmon or trout or something would be
more
active, but not now. Those little buggers are. You imagine catching 35 bass in one day?
That's a good day.
It was cold and miserable, as he said, and the water temperature was not much more than 40.
Yeah, that's
or
good.
Or maybe a little less, but that was great.
All right.
Okay, young Thomas and his buddy, whose name of Alex Briggs, have been invited to fish in a national youth bass tournament. A national youth bass tournament, and he will he went yet last year, as you know, so this is second year they're going.
Good for them.
And it's going to be held in Tennessee, and that's quite a thing, isn't it, for a young man like that?
Yeah, they've done well.
You remember him?
Yes, I do.
He's a woolly bugger.
You bet.
He and his father both.
Yeah.
And he used to come down to Grand Lake Stream quite often. He didn't come last year, but we hope he'll come next year.
Well, we wish them best of luck in the National Bass Tournament.
We certainly do.
All right.
So that's a good report, I think, on that young man. And he's quite a fisherman. He's developed into quite a fisherman.
Good. That's great. Good to see youngsters come along. You
that's
bet.
That's right.
Yeah. All right.
We have a caller.
We have a caller standing by. We don't usually take calls during Outdoor Digest, but what the heck. Let's take one. Good evening, caller. You're on Maine Outdoors.
Well, that's interesting. I'm Michael Good down at Bar Harbor. And I just, you know, we don't really have fishermen down here. I don't know if you know that.
You don't?
So, there aren't really any fishermen along the coast of Maine here. And we're trying to figure out how to get people on the same page as far as ecology to get our fisheries back. And we'd sure love if you guys up on the mainland would start to promote, you know, reconnecting our streams and reconnecting our rivers back into the Gulf of Maine so that someday we might have some fishermen here. So if you guys have any ideas on how to get the government to join on board to revive our marine fisheries and, you know, enhance that fisheries coming out of the Penobscot River and out of some of these other major rivers, that would be really great.
All right. Well, that's a large topic, and we appreciate your thought on that, and we'll give it some some discussion. Maybe we can find somebody to come in and talk about marine fisheries.
Yeah, well, it's not marine fisheries. It's the alewives and those guys that we're worried about, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the alewives that are connected to the marine fisheries.
Yeah. All right, so we appreciate your call.
We're all connected, so thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, bye-bye.
Yeah, take care.
Hey, Paul, did somebody in your family get a deer?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Boy, my grandson, Eli.
Oh, yeah.
Got his first deer. Got a doe Saturday morning during youth day. Yeah. Congratulations to my grandson,
Eli.
Well,
I should say. How old is he?
It's too bad the assistant engineer has to remind me of that.
Oh, no, actually, I got a mystery phone call.
Oh, you did, a mystery phone call.
How old is Eli?
He's 13.
Wow, he did well, didn't he?
And he whacked that deer with his grandmother's 7mm .08.
Oh, man.
dropped it right on the spot.
I bet he did.
Congratulations to you, Eli, and thanks for reminding me, Norm. I appreciate
it. There you go.
That. All right, good. And I think that wraps up Outdoor Digest, brought to you by the Northwood Sporting Journal. Our guests again are Jake Morrill and Gary Dumont, who's a retired Maine Warden pilot. They have a book they conspired to put together, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. Before we do, though, we have a subscription to the Northwood Sporting Journal worth $30 to give away to you. If you can, we have a kind of an interesting, kind of an offbeat question tonight. And if you like this question, you can, or if you don't like it, you can blame my wife, Diane, and you can call her at 745-0049.
Yeah, right. Good luck.
This is her idea. Normally, we ask you a question like, you know, what's a gray ghost and what's a 30-30, stuff like that. This is an interesting question. A poem has been written, one of my favorites, about deer camp. And she said, well, why not have Bob Lehman just do a brief stanza from that poem and then see if your listeners can guess either the name of the poem or the author who wrote it. If you have either, if you can give us either answer, we'll give you a subscription to the journal. And again, it's about a deer camp, but it has a title. It's not called Deer Camp. Okay, Bob Lehman, go ahead.
This is a famous poem about a deer camp. After we read a stanza from the poem, you tell us either the name of the author or the name of the poem. And some of the quotes that you
this
can...
This is just an excerpt from the poem.
Excerpts, okay. Yep, a man can live for a solid week in the same old underbrushes and walk like a man and spit when he wants and scratch himself where he itches. I tell you, boys, there's no place else where I'd rather be come fall.
All right. If you think you know the title to that poem or the author, call us at 1-800-966-1039, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back with Maine Outdoors, and we'll be talking to our studio guest momentarily, but we have an outdoor trivia question we'd like to dispose of, and we're looking. We have two callers stacked up, so let's take the first one. Good evening, caller. You're on Maine Outdoors.
Is it me?
Yeah, you're on. What do you think? Oh, okay. What's your first name, and what do you think the answer might be?
Oh, this is Joe. I live in Trenton, and it's my favorite, the Palace in the Popple.
Oh, Joe, excellent.
John Olin or something like that.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites, too. You like that, huh?
Oh, I saw that in an outdoor cookbook by Joe Brooks in the 70s.
Oh, did you? Yeah, yeah.
And it's a good one. I've got it on the... They've got it into our hunting camp.
Yeah, well, you're obviously a deer hunter. Yeah, that's great. Okay, Joe, where are you calling us from again?
Trenton.
Up in Trenton? Oh, down in Trenton. Yeah,
down in Trenton.
Yeah, well, I live in Ellsworth, not far from you. Well, nice to have you on the program tonight, Joe. We appreciate you listening and playing the game. If you'll stay on the line, Norm will get your mailing address, and we'll make sure you get signed up for a year's subscription to the Sporting Journal.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thank you, Joe, and have a good season.
You too.
All right, thank you.
See ya. Bye-bye.
All right, that was the correct answer. Palace in the Popple, and it was written by a hunter named... George Augustus Bixby.
Bixby.
I think it was from Wisconsin, I believe.
Really?
Deer hunter from Wisconsin.
I like that name, Bixby.
Yeah, it's a great poem. Yeah,
sounds like something that an old comedian, W.C. Fields, would name himself in one of his movies.
Anyway, it's a great poem. If you're a deer hunter, I commend it to you. You can Google it. It's called Palace in the Popple by George Bixby.
Yep.
Okay, let's get down to business here and cut to the chase. Again, if you just joined us, our guests are Jake Morrill and Gary Dumont. Jake has written a couple of books. He's a retired professional bush flyer who also ran a sporting camp at Hardscrabble Lodge. And Gary is had been a game warden pilot for 20 years, and he's from Fort Kent, Maine, and we're going to be talking to them both right now. Before we get to Gary, Jake, I think it would be appropriate for you to tell our listeners what seized you to want to do this book with Gary Dumont.
Well, the way it started, I was invited to talk about the book I wrote about Dick Folsom in Bangor, and Gary was at the event, and I hadn't seen him in a while, so we caught up. And then on the way home, I was talking to my wife. I said, you know, if there's anyone that's got stories, it's Gary. And I said, I'm going to contact him and see if he'd be interested. So when I got home, I did, and he said, let's do it, and that's how it started.
Yeah, so you guys knew each other before the book, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, quite a while.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the book is called Gary Dumont Remembers, and it's a conversation that you had. Basically, you sat down with Gary and asked a bunch of questions and recorded it.
That's correct.
And it's been transcribed in a book almost word for word?
I did the transcribing, and it is word for word.
Yeah, all right. That's great. That's what makes it so compelling, I think. Gary, listeners who may not know you, tell us a little bit. How did you happen to get the flying bug? And this started way back when you were just in high school, right?
Oh, I had the flying bug before high school. My father ran a flying service in the late 40s into the late 50s before he went to work as a state trooper. And I can't remember not being around airplanes.
Oh, so you grew up with airplanes.
I grew up with airplanes. Okay. I knew Mac Mayhew when I was like 7 or 8 years old.
And who was Mac Mayhew?
Mac Mayhew was a warden pilot in Eagle Lake back in the late 40s, stayed there till into the late 50s.
Yeah. So you cut your teeth on airplanes way back then when you were just a
youngster. Oh, yeah, that's what
youngster.
It was all about.
Yeah. And so you after high school, you joined the military, right?
Yeah, actually, my senior year in high school, I applied to go to the flight school. They had a program called High School to Flight School, and I figured that was better than running around in the rice paddies on an M-16. But you know, you had to, it was quite involved to get qualified and everything, and I got accepted, and I went to flight school right out of high school.
And you flew Hueys in Vietnam for a whole year, right?
All of 1970.
Yeah. How many hours did you?
1,410 hours 1 year.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow. That must have been quite an experience. So you came back here with a lot of flying time, so it was a natural for you to flow into the warden service?
Yeah. Well, I knew I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to be a warden pilot, okay? But the chances of that was kind of slim because when they hired a pilot, he'd stick around for a long time. And so I got back and I worked Presque Isle at Roosic Airways for a little while, and a forestry job opened up, a pilot's job. And I applied and I got the job. And I worked there about a year and a half.
So did you ever fly with Scotty Bates?
Oh, yeah.
Our guy Scotty?
Oh, yeah, before Scotty.
Before Scotty, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So you flew for the Forest Service for a number of years?
For a year and a half.
Yeah. Why did you have this burning passion to become a warden pilot, Gary?
You know, I just was around it, and I liked float planes. Look, I could have gone to a different direction in aviation. Probably have been made a lot more money and stuff, but I just like float flying. I like ski flying. Hey, listen, helicopter flying was great, but all that did was get me to where I wanted to go. You know, you had to get some experience, and that's how that come about.
So you like fixed-wing airplanes better than helicopters?
If I had to answer that, I'd say yeah. I mean, helicopters are great, and it was really something, but, you know, my thing is float planes and ski planes.
Yeah. And you wanted to couple that. You loved flying, but you wanted to couple that with being a law enforcement officer, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do warden pilots, kind of a silly question. I should know this because I used to work for Fish and Wildlife, but I don't know the answer. But do warden pilots issue that many summons?
Oh, yeah. You know, I don't know. I probably actually handed out 6 or 8 summons in my career. Usually
Usually
you're the eyes of the wardens, okay?
Yeah.
And a lot of times, you flew wardens every day, you know. But we were responsible for a lot of summonses.
Yeah, I'm sure you were.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you became a warden pilot, and this was like, what roughly era was this?
72.
1972. And back then, now the legendary warden pilots before you, one of them was Mac, right?
Mac
and Andy Stinson.
Andy is a close friend of mine till he passed away just a few months ago.
George Layton.
George hired me. Yep. No, really kidding. Yeah. Yep.
He did hire you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I helped to teach George and Andy to fly helicopters when I was a forestry pilot because I was a flight instructor.
One of the things that Jake and I have talked about, and I think anybody who knows the slightest thing about bush flying knows that it's unpredictable, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a little different. You know, there's nobody you call tell you what the wind's doing at Clear Lake, yep. You know, or whatever. You're on your own.
And you don't have somebody in air traffic control telling you what the weather front is, yeah. And you just have to figure it out on your own.
You know, for example, I can remember flying a whole month maybe out of Eagle Lake in the winter and not landing on a paved runway.
Yeah, amazing. So let's go back to the first year that you were a warden pilot. Can you remember, like if I had been a warden pilot back then, I wouldn't be able to tell you what I did because my memory's not that great. But do you remember the first year?
I can remember the first day I worked in Greenville. Yeah. The next morning I went to Squawpan Lake on a search. Morris Gordon was the district game warden, and I found this guy on the upper end of Squawpan. I had to break through a quarter mile ice to get to him. He got down to shore. I remember that. That was the first thing I did as a warden pilot.
So wait a minute now. I'm getting a little confused. There was a guy lost on the lake?
He was lost over. He ended up on the lake, okay?
He was a flyer?
No, he was just a hunter.
Oh, he was a hunter. Okay.
Yeah,
and he was disoriented.
Yeah.
And you spotted him from the air?
Spotted him, and I see him. I mean, knew it was. There's no camps there, nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew it was our guy, and that whole cove was froze. And I'd never done that, but I'd heard the guys talk about doing that.
So you landed and...
Landed, and I broke the ice. It was just a skim ice. And,
Okay. We're going to have more discussion here with these gents, and we invite you to weigh in, too. We'll be right back with more here on Maine Outdoors.
More Maine Outdoors next on 101.3 Augusta, 103.9 Bangor, 95.1 Rockland, the voice of Maine.
Okay, we're back with Maine Outdoors and our studio guests, Jake Morrill and Gary Dumont, a retired warden pilot. And we are going to be asking all kinds of questions. There's some great, great stories over 20 years of flying the bush. But first, we have callers who may have questions as well. Good evening, caller. You're on Maine Outdoors with yes. Warden pilot Gary Dumont. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Malika Russell, and I go by Emmy. I wanted to know if you knew my father. I know he helped a lot up north by flying. He was out of Pittsfield, and his name was Jack Russell. Does anybody know him? Or
I've heard the name. I didn't know the gentleman.
Oh, okay.
I didn't know him.
He helped with a lot of fly-ins in Greenville, too.
I see. Oh, great. What was his name again?
So, Jack Russell?
No, not familiar with the name.
I remember Jack Russell.
Oh, Jim Layton. Yes. Jim Layton's a bush flyer, and he remembers Jack.
I'd met him in Greenville on a couple occasions.
Yeah.
Great guy.
Sure.
Great guy.
Thank you.
All right.
That was my dad.
Well, we appreciate you listening tonight.
Well, I listen all the time. It's a great program, and it's a great magazine that I got from Bob.
Well, thank you. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
And we didn't pay you to say that, did we?
No.
Oh. All right.
Maybe not much.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. We appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody.
Have a good
Thank
night.
You. Bye-bye.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, we have another caller standing by. Good evening, caller. You're in Maine Outdoors with retired warden pilot Gary Dumont. Go ahead.
Good morning. Good morning, or good evening, gentlemen. My name is Bob. I'm asked the retired warden Dumont if he remembers any stories about a warden airplane splashing down in First Musquequick Lake many years ago.
Yeah, that was actually went through the ice. That was in the late 40s, that was Mac Mayu on First Musquequick, and he lost the oil pressure. That's all in the book. And he knew that he wasn't going to stay up on the ice. There's pictures of the airplane. And he made it, he spent the night in old camp. And that old camp, the remains of it are still there. It's all fallen in.
Actually, I own that camp, and the reason I was calling is because I've heard stories about this, and I've never actually talked to anybody that could actually substantiate the stories.
Okay, you bought the camp from Jimmy Dumont.
I did, yes.
Okay, well, that camp is the second camp at that location. The original camp was behind your camp and a little bit to the south. And the last time I was there was probably 20-some years ago, and the walls was only a couple feet high, so it's probably all gone now.
I've frogged around there for several years, and I've never seen any remains of anything before.
Talk about small world. Isn't it incredible? Yeah.
You said Mark's last name was what?
Malcolm Mayhew.
I'm sorry, Mac what?
Malcolm Mayhew.
Okay. Mayhew.
In the book, there's a plate that is Mac's written description of that event, along with a picture of his plane.
Yeah, I have it right here. Yeah.
I guess I'm going to have to buy that darn book.
Oh, you better.
You got to have this book, fella. I'm telling you, you just got to have it. It's called Gary Dumont Remembers, and if you'd like to get a copy of it, you can get it by going to there's a website called HardscrabbleLodge.com, all one word, Hardscrabble Lodge, all one word. Just go to HardscrabbleLodge.com, or you can also go to MainAuthorsPublishing.com, and you can get a copy of the book that way. All right.
Well, I'll do that. And thanks for entertaining my question.
Listen, if you walk down to the lake from your camp, stand on the shore, look off to the right, where Mac went through is about not quite 100 yards, maybe, right along the shore. That's where that picture is taken.
Well, you know how much that my camp is probably probably less than 100 yards from the camp. And you know how the stuff overgrows now. You would never know anything was there 10 years later.
Amazing, yeah. Well, we appreciate the call. Thank you very much. That was very educational and very interesting. We appreciate it.
You guys have a good evening. Thanks for your show.
Okay. Good luck to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Any more calls stacked up right now? We don't, right?
That is it.
Okay. I want to ask you, Gary, one of the things that's always fascinated me is the wardens call the lost people scenario. When I worked for the Fish and Wildlife Department, I was as a press guy, I was on the edge of some of these searches, and I was always fascinated with the theory and the technique and all the hard work they put in to find people. Do you, as a guy who found over 200 people in your career, did you notice that there was a certain type of behavior that lost people? Are they predictable? As a warden pilot going up, you're up there looking, searching for somebody, like finding a needle in the haystack. Do you have hunches that you follow when you're trying to do something like this?
Yeah, you know, you'd say, okay, is he going to get over in that valley? Is he going to hit the stream? And the thing that I found over the years, they were always further away than you thought they were going to go. I mean, how far a hunter will go in a day or day and a half is sometimes it's just unbelievable. Yeah.
And that's sort of contrary to the advice that we're given. The advice is always, if you find out you think you're lost, stay put.
Yeah.
But a lot of guys don't, do they?
You know, and we always told people, find the space, show your face, build a fire. You build a fire, we're going to get you, and we ain't going to be all day doing it.
Yeah.
But in the 20 years, I don't know if I had a dozen people build a fire.
Well, sometimes it's tough.
Yeah.
Starting a fire, like on a drizzly day, can be tough if you're not experienced at it.
That was a call the wardens dreaded to get, was a lost person.
Jeez.
I'm telling you, that was it.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, you know, bad news.
Yeah. So the lost people thing, and one of the things we talked about during the break, and I think it's worth sharing with listeners, is that once the law required the wearing of Hunter Orange, that sort of revolutionized your ability as a pilot to find people, didn't it?
Completely different deal. It was, you can't imagine how much easier it made our job.
Just easier to spot somebody.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole thing is the safety aspect, you know, so that, you know, another hunter doesn't, you know, mistake you or something. But it really helped as far as searching. It was just out of this world.
Yeah. And so a lot of times you couldn't just land, pick somebody up. You would be the eyes for the warden on the ground, right?
Yeah, a lot of times we did. Of course, you don't get near the lost hunters now. There's roads everywhere. We get people that call in lost on their cell phone, you know, and they just don't know how to get.
Yeah.
But, you know, back in the day, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of times we picked them up. I've picked up a lot of people, you know, and land on a pond and other, you've walked people out. I've hollered out of the Super Cub. I've hollered the guys and get them to turn on a road, you know, and I remember walking a guy right out to a warden pickup.
Right. So you just kind of put the flaps out and slow down and open the window and yell out to him?
Yeah, it okay. was a lot easier to do it in a Cub-type airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and but we'd walk wardens into them a lot. I mean, you know, once we got walkie-talkies, that's another whole deal. That was, you know, you could walk a guy right into a law center.
Yeah, and that happened quite a lot, did it?
Oh, yeah, and you yeah. try to get the hunter not to move, you know, because you didn't want to lose him again, you know. And you'd walk people right into them. We'd done that many, many, many times.
I'm going to ask you, were you involved in the search for the missing hunter? I think it would have been back in the 90s up in Garfield Plantation near Ashland.
That's right after I were retired. You no, I wasn't involved. That's right after I retired.
Yeah. You know, that has been a real mystery. Nobody to this day knows what happened to that guy. And Roger Gay, who I'm sure you've worked with, Roger was so frustrated and enthralled by trying to figure out what happened to that guy that I think he went back on his own with his search dogs and tried a couple of times to try to figure out whatever happened to him. And I was up there during that search, and they found a boot print that had to be his, but they could not pin it down. And there were grid searches that went on there for days and days, and to this day, nobody knows what happened to that guy.
That's happened a few times over the years. We never found. We had a forester or something way up on the St. John River, we saw his tracks, and we never found that guy.
No,
in November.
Have you ever been lost in the woods, Paul?
Yes, I have.
You know, you're an honest man, because just about everybody who's been hunting
turned around
at some time or another has been lost or turned around.
If you like to get in the deep woods and walk, you get a little disoriented.
Sure you do.
Norm has never been lost.
No. Well, it's the exception, you know.
I have once. And it's left a lasting impression.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I have been lost, badly lost, scary lost.
Oh, wow.
And but anyway, today they say, the wardens say, everybody has a false sense of security because they got that darn cell phone with them, right? So they can go anywhere, not worry. Oh, don't even need a compass. Well. Just take your cell phone, right? Because if you run out of battery, you're dead, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Gary, that's wonderful. I think we have to do a little short commercial break here, and then we're going to continue. Again, if you have a question for Gary or Jake, you can call us at 1-800-966-1039. And Bob Lehman wants to tell you a little bit about General Appliance and Brewer.
How would anybody not want to go to General Appliance and Brewer? You know, they have everything you'd want in camp appliance needs, including gas lights, gas ranges, gas refrigerators, gas freezers, or top-of-the-line compost toilets.
Ride the wave, baby.
All right. Yes, right, baby. General Appliance is located at 91 Center Street in Brewer. Easy to find. Come across the old Bangor Bridge, Brewer Bridge. Take a right and a left. You're right on Center Street, and they got practically the whole block right there on the right. You can't miss them. And they also have services for, you know, if you need any parts or anything. They're loaded with parts. They got everything you need for all makes, including Cervells and gas refrigerators and compost toilets even. As Jim said,
ride the wave, baby.
Okay, Jimmy. Thank you so much.
And you know what I like? Can I say something here?
Yeah.
You know, Al Elkin, who owns the place,
yeah,
Proprietor, he's a great guy.
He
sells our books and everything. But
he's
what I like about Al is, you know, I have a couple of camps in the backwoods, and I have propane, and I can't get a guy to go in there.
No.
Even Al. He said, I'm not going to go.
No. Well, you can't blame him, no.
But if I have a problem, I go to Al.
Go to Al.
Because I'm not a trained propane guy.
He can tell you what you need
for
parts.
But he tells me what I need for parts.
Sure, how to install them.
Yeah. So if you have a camp with propane appliances or gas lights and you got a problem, go see Al. You can't do that at over those big box stores,
at any
right?
big job store, you can't
you
do
can't
that.
Do
no,
that. No.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but you can't
with
Al.
Also have compost toilets, as you know. And the big thing about compost toilets is there's no running water.
No leach fields.
No leach fields. No plumbing.
Issues, no mosquitoes.
That's the big thing. No mosquitoes.
All right.
And, of course, General Appliance has a full line of our books, both Paul's and I's. And right there is the door. As you come in, you can't miss it. A big rack full of our books.
Yes, sir.
They got some great heaters there. Sale on his heaters, too.
Oh, they're having a sale there on the heaters?
Yes, sir. He's
they
got
are.
Some great,
we'll go over
great
there.
Wall heaters.
Go over there and check them out. Patronize them as we do. We encourage you to do so. Okay, again, our guests are Jake Morrill and Gary Dumont, who's a retired pilot. And we have a caller standing by. Good evening, caller. You're on Maine Outdoors.
Hi, my name is Levi Sewell. I'm a Brewer police officer.
Hi, Levi.
And I've known Gary Dumont since I was a little tyke. back in Aetna, and then moved up to East Millinocket, Maine. My father's a retired game warden, David Sewell.
Oh, all right.
And Gary gave me probably, there aren't too many perks, being a game warden's son that I can remember. I mean, I was proud of my father for everything that he did. But there aren't too many perks that come with a young fella whose father's a game warden. But Gary Dumont flying me around on my first, you know, experiences in an airplane was probably one of them. And I never, ever thanked Gary for that. And I just want to take a moment and first thank him for his service. And secondly, I just want to thank him for those experiences that I actually got.
Hey, thanks, Levi. You got a great dad.
Oh, yeah. He's still kicking strong. And every so often we'll talk about, you know, his experiences and whatnot, and your name will come up. So, but again, like I said, for a young fella, that was really quite something to be able to hop in an airplane with you and get those first experiences in the air. It was, you know, something that I'm 48 years old now, and I mean, I remember those as plain as day to this day. So thank you very much. I never did thank you.
Hey, appreciate it.
All right. That was nice. Very thoughtful. Appreciate the call. Thank you, sir.
Yes, okay. Sir. Thank you.
All right. We have another caller standing by. Good evening. You're in Maine Outdoors with retired warden pilot Gary Dumont. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi, Gary. Yeah, I want to thank you for your military service, and I had a question. What was your most harrowing experience in Vietnam, Gary?
Yeah, when you're 20 years old, you probably don't think you have many harrowing experiences. I mean, you know, I can honestly say I never was scared, because if you got time to be scared, something isn't right. You know, I lost a Huey. We had a fire and nobody got hurt, and there's nothing left of that. I even got pictures of it. And afterwards, you think about it. But, you know, every day there was something going on there. You know, you weren't out there every day. There was a war going on. It didn't make a difference if the weather was bad or good. The wind blew hard. You still went, because of the war doesn't stop because the wind's blowing 50.
Where was your home base in Vietnam, Gary?
It was a place called Bear Cat, which was east-southeast of Saigon. And then about 5 months into the year, about like in May of 70, we moved to a place called Dong Tam, way down in the delta of Vietnam.
Okay. You got any stories about Square Lake?
Yeah, it's all good. The Square Lake is a, you know, I grew up there a lot. My father managed a set of camps there on Square Lake. Of course, the only way you got there was by airplane. And boy, I'm going to tell you, next to Moosehead, that's a rough piece of water. The wind can blow there.
Yep.
All right. We appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and this fascinates me, because I used to own a little tail dragger. And so I know a little bit about it, but I'm just interested. I want to talk about cold weather starts, because that always fascinates me. I don't know if that'd be fascinating to the average listener or not, but before we do that, I do want you to tell something that will fascinate the listeners, and that's the story about Cash Austin and Mr. Kelly.
Earl Kelly.
Earl Kelly, yeah.
If any of the retired wardens are listening, they've all heard this story. And, I mean, this happened before I was born, I guess. Earl Kelly was a district game warden. He was also a pilot. And Cash Austin was a warden supervisor, lived on Cross Lake. And Earl was flying Mac Mayhew's airplane for a short period. Mac was gone somewhere. And in November, he went over to Cross Lake, picked up Cash at his house. He lived right there. And it was a pretty raw day. Wind was blowing. The water rudders would freeze. Float flying in the fall it ain't a piece of cake, but just it's something you got to do. Well, anyway, he picked up Cash. They flew around for an hour or so looking at fields and stuff. They come back into land, and they got on the water. He's having a hard time steering because the water rudders were freezing. And he told Cash, he said, I'm going to pull right in alongside the dock. And he said, I'm just going to let it idle. When it gets up close, you jump up on the dock. Cash says, okay. So Cash gets out on the pontoon behind the wing struts. And they get right up to the dock. And I can just imagine what kind of a dock that was. And you know, about the time Earl figured he jumped, he turned into the wind and started to give it power. And as he gave it the power, he started hearing some rapping on the fabric. And, of course, he figured it was the seatbelt, because quite often in a Cub-type airplane, we'd close the door and the seatbelt would be hanging out and it would beat against. Well, about then he looks out to the right and there's Cash, got his hands on the wing struts, water coming right out of his mouth. And supposedly that happened, and I know it happened, but the story, I'm sure, built over the years. And, of course, Cash always claimed that Earl did it on purpose, and, of course, there was a school of thought there that probably he might have.
So he almost went for a ride outside. Funny. Cold weather starts. There's a section in the book, Jake, right, where you ask questions about that.
Yes, there is.
And I know that's always an issue because you have these engines with oil in them and everything, and you're talking about evenings where it's down to zero or below.
Yeah.
Probably a lot more than that up in your country. Can you talk a little bit about that, Gary? What were the different methods used to heat that engine up before you could start it?
Well, when I come to work in the early 70s, you know, there was still Andy Stinson worked as a Warden pilot over 20 years and never had the privilege of a hangar. He kept the airplane in Coldstream Pond, and all winter he would preheat that with a plumber's pot. That's quite an operation. When you first start it, the flames go everywhere. Then it warms up the generator, and you know, and then you heat it. But you've got to warm it up, because you don't warm it up for 5 minutes. It takes a fair amount of time, you know, because if you try to start it and it backfires, then the plugs they get a little bit ice on them. Well, you're never going to start it then. And so that was the most common way back in the day, and they were still doing that when I come to work. Then we got these propane heaters they call Red Dragon. I still got one. And that puts out a lot of heat. You put a blanket over the cowling, and, you know, you start it. Well, now they've got these I had one of these before I retired. They got this system that they put in. There's probes go into the cylinders, and there's a pad on the oil a reservoir, and you plug that in and you leave it plugged in, okay? And that's when you start the airplane. I mean, two winters ago when I flew all winter, I mean, I start some mornings 25 below, and it's like starting it in June.
Wow.
Okay? And but you got to have power for that. You couldn't do that up to Big Eagle or over to Churchill. You know, you got to have electricity to do that. And they never had, when Mac was first a pilot in Eagle Lake, they never had a hangar there. I think the hangar was built in 57 or 58. So Mac, I can remember as a little boy going there, my father, and he'd have the Super Cruiser out there, and that's how they would heat it up. And it had straight skis, you know, there was no wheel skis like they got today. And he would taxi it. He had these big planks covered with burlap. And they were they would soak them in kerosene. Well, you wouldn't do that today because you wouldn't get away with it. He had those on the lake, and that's what he would pull up onto so the skis wouldn't freeze to the ice.
Oh, yeah. A lot of tricks.
Oh, hey, listen, you just did jump in the airplane and go. It takes a lot to get that ready to go.
So I remember seeing some old movie about an Alaska bush pilot draining the oil and taking it in and getting in bed with it to keep it warm.
Well, I've never got in bed with it, but I've done that. We've done that.
Drain the oil out?
Drain the oil. The first few years I worked, I remember doing that a few times. Then we had a system called oil dilution. And with the engine running, after you'd come back from the flight, you'd predict there was going to be 20 below, and then you had a chart, and you'd push this button. They would inject gasoline into the oil. The oil was warm, and it would thin it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and of course it cranked over a lot easier in the morning, but there was issues with that, because when you do that, it would wash sludge and stuff off the cylinders, you know, and so it wasn't the best of systems. The old folks in the old days with the big radial engines, I mean, they'd pour gasoline right into the oil sump.
Wow.
You know, when the oil was hot.
Yeah. Jim Layton, is he still here?
Yes, right here.
You hear Jim?
Yeah.
Jim, you're an old bush flyer, and you and I owned the same airplane at one time. But one of the things I used to worry about when I preheated that old airplane of ours was catching it on fire.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
You know, is that happens to people, doesn't it?
Oh, I've seen it happen.
You have?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that was worried me.
What I did that cured that old engine from cold starts is I put the I injected the fuel right into the cylinders instead of down below and below the carburetor in the box. And that way, when you give it a prime, it went right into the cylinders.
on
that same engine. I'm still flying that same engine in the T-craft.
Yeah, that was in our old airplane, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I understand our airplane is such an antique now. It's down at the
Owl's Head Museum.
Owl's Head Museum, right?
It sure is.
Yeah, wow.
Yep.
What does that say about us, Jim? Yeah. Okay. It wasn't all...
1 minute.
Oh, we only have a minute left.
Wow. You don't even have a minute.
Okay. Well, before we run out of time here, again, thank you for being here, Gary. You've done a great job. And thank you for your service to your country. Thank you for your service to the Maine Warden Service. It's really appreciated. And I guess you're still flying a little bit for them, right? Or you have been?
I just finished a 3-month deal there, help them out, and I still enjoy it.
Yeah. Well, if I get lost up around Second Musquaycook, I hope you look for me.
Build a fire.
I will build a fire, and I'll be dressed in red. Blaze orange.
Yes.
Yeah. Jake, thank you for dragging Gary down here. We really appreciate that.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
And good luck with your book to both of you. It's a wonderful book. And again, if somebody wants to get it, they go to hardscrabblelodge.com. And it's available there and also at Maine Authors Publishing. And have a safe winter up there in Fort Kent. I'm sorry to hear the snow on the ground already, Gary, but I know you expect it, right?
Yeah.
You bet.
Costs a lot more money not to have snow.
Yes, yeah, right. and again, thanks a lot, gents. We appreciate you being here. And next week, Bob, I'm endeavoring to get Professor Jim Dill to come in again and talk about ticks.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You remember?
Yeah, moose ticks and so forth, and all ticks, as far as that goes. Yeah.
I'm running into more and more people that are suffering from Lyme disease.
I know it.
Just incredible.
I know it.
That's not a problem up your way, right? Ticks too bad up in the county? Yeah. All right. And anyway, Bob and I will be here with our guests next week, and we'll see you all next week right here on
Maine Outdoors.